This podcast is on the assessment and management of fractures of the acetabulum. I think one of the most important things you need to take away from this is the importance of radiographic interpretation to understand the fracture pattern and realize how that dictates treatment and dictates surgical approach. You know, in orthopedic trauma, one of the nice things is that understanding of what you're dealing with is usually not that complicated. The fun part is in trying to figure out how to treat it. Usually, plain radiographs, a CT scan, you can get a good idea what's going on with a femur fracture or a patella fracture, a forearm fracture, for instance. You know, the diagnosis is not the hard part. We don't spend a ton of time. I don't mean to belittle it, but diagnosis is relatively straightforward. Acetabulum fractures is different in that the bony anatomy is a lot more complicated, right? You're not dealing with just a long bone or a flat bone. I mean, you're dealing with a very sort of curved, three-dimensional structure with a lot of radiographic shadows on top of shadows, and understanding what's going on and exactly where the fracture is actually not that straightforward. In Judé and Letourneau's book on fractures of the acetabulum, a huge portion of the book is dedicated to trying to recognize and understand radiographic patterns and interpreting radiographs to understand fracture patterns. I think even with CT scans and three-dimensional reconstructive images, it still is very essential to have a deep understanding of the bony anatomy and what you see on a radiograph that translates to what the patient actually has. As a matter of fact, in the early days, Judé and Letourneau sometimes would open a fracture and realize that they were approaching it from the wrong side because they didn't truly understand where the fracture was and that the surgical approach they were doing didn't get them there. Of course, those are mistakes we absolutely try to avoid today, but that just puts it in perspective. So the other thing is, you know, anatomy is relatively unfamiliar. I kind of hinted at this before. The bony anatomy is a little bit complicated, but the soft tissue anatomy is also relatively unfamiliar. So this is a topic where, we talk about surgical approaches, the ilioinguinal approach and anterior intrapelvic approach and stop approach and extended iliofemoral approach. And a lot of these approaches that go through anatomy that you're often not familiar with, especially the anterior approaches, right? At least orthopedic surgeons are not so familiar with. So I think that's the other complicated thing about this topic. So I think when you're reviewing this topic, you need to get really familiar with anatomy that you're otherwise not used to seeing. I think another important issue is that reduction matters. Matters there in a lot of places, right? But you could argue in the tibial plateau, for instance, an anatomic reduction is nice, but a millimeter here or there may not necessarily dictate outcome that strongly as it does in the acetabulum. I think Joel Mata's data, for instance, has shown that the degree of reduction, that is anatomic reductions, especially in the weight-bearing dome, essentially lead to better outcomes than non-anatomic reductions. So for some reason, the acetabulum, the hip joint, and in the weight-bearing portion in particular, getting accurate reductions is really critical. And that's not really the case with every articular fracture that we can think of, in other parts of the body. I gave the knee as an example, distal radius is another example. There are non-operative indications. Sometimes you don't have to operate on an acetabulum fracture. So for instance, a fracture that's not that displaced, perhaps that doesn't involve the weight-bearing articular surface, either defined by roof arc angles or on your CT scan, sometimes you don't need to be operated on. fractures that are minimally displaced, you know, less than, you know, 1 or 2 millimeters, and you can essentially demonstrate congruence on all three views between the femoral head and acetabulum, probably can be treated non-operatively. Another case that we see often is these posterior wall fractures, where we have, by whatever method you use to measure, a relatively small posterior wall fracture. So it's, you know, if they're like 20-25% or less, and are stable, if you consider doing stress views, these can often be treated non-operatively. And interestingly, some of the most severe acetabulum fractures that you can get, such as an associated both column fracture in particular, that fracture pattern can achieve something called secondary congruence. So on the flip side, one of the operative indications is incongruence, right? So if you have a transverse acetabular fracture, for example, and it's incongruent, the hip joint is just, you know, the femoral head and acetabulum are incongruent, that's an indication for operative management. And with one fracture type, the associated both column fracture, you can achieve secondary congruence. And if you truly have secondary congruence and you're happy with the position of the femoral head and you don't think it's too medialized, then that sometimes can be treated non-operatively as well. Just another word about the associated both column fracture. It is essentially the equivalent of the AO type C periarticular fracture. And what I mean by that is it's a complete articular fracture, right? The all of the articular fragments are completely dissociated from the sciatic buttress in the posterior part of the pelvis. And that's the only fracture type where you get that. If you look very carefully at all the elementary types, all five of them, and if you look at the other four associated types, all of them have at least a portion of the a portion of the articular surface in continuity with the sciatic buttress posteriorly, okay, except for the associated both columns. So because all those fragments are sort of free, so to speak, they are free to follow the femoral head and sort of try to articulate with it. And sometimes what you get is a medialized acetabulum at the end, but a congruent acetabulum, and sometimes that can be treated non-operatively. So the main surgical approaches you should be familiar with are the classic Judean Latronelle approaches, which are the Coker-Langenbeck approach posteriorly, the ilio-inguinal approach anteriorly, and the extended iliofemoral approach, which is an extensile approach to both columns. Some surgical approaches will have modifications, such as a Coker-Langenbeck sometimes can be extended into so-called triradiate. An ilioinguinal can have an iliofemoral extension. The ilioinguinal can also have an expanded medial window, also known as a stoppa window or anterior intrapelvic window. These are all modifications, and I think we review them in some of the video lectures from the orthopedic trauma series as well. You should be familiar with which fracture types are indicated for which exposure. So for instance, the Coker-Langenbeck approach is an approach utilized for posterior wall fractures, posterior column fractures, associated posterior column and wall fractures, associated transverse with posterior wall fractures. And it can be used with many transverse fractures, especially if the transverse fracture is more involved posteriorly. And it can be used for a lot of T-shaped fractures, again, if a majority of the component is more displaced posteriorly. Now, the anterior ilioinguinal approach is used for anterior wall fractures, anterior column fractures, associated anterior column and posterior hemitransverse, and most associated both column fractures. The extended iliofemoral approach, which is an extensile approach, is used pretty infrequently in most surgeons' hands. The good thing is it allows you to not only approach both columns at the same time, but you can also do a capsulotomy and view the joint at the same time. It forces you to rotate all of the abductors on their neurovascular pedicle, so you have to make sure the superior gluteal artery and vein are patent and working, and if they're not, you could devascularize everything. But it's indicated for, at least according to Letourneau, the transtectal transverse and transtectal T-shaped fractures, certain both column fractures, especially if you have a lot of segmental involvement of the posterior column, and also fractures that are delayed, that are presented greater than 3 weeks out. Another topic you should probably be a little bit aware of are geriatric fracture patterns. We're seeing more and more of these. They usually involve the anterior column and have some type of anterior wall or anterior column fracture, sometimes with a posterior hemitransverse component. So they're often treated anteriorly, and because they often have a lot of protrusio, the stoppa window or anterior intrapelvic approach, where you can very effectively buttress from the opposite side of the patient, is an effective approach. Complications, unfortunately, can occur. I think the one to keep in mind that I'll highlight here before we end is heterotopic ossification. This is something, and it seems to be correlated with elevating the abductors off of the outer table. So the extended iliofemoral approach, for instance, has a high risk for heterotopic ossification. If you do a Coker-Langenbeck approach with a trochanteric flip, for instance, and you elevate the abductors, that's going to increase your incidence. Similarly, the triradiate will have an increased incidence, whereas the ilioinguinal, where you're working on the inner table, has a much lower incidence of heterotopic ossification. Oftentimes, it's the gluteus minimus that develops this, and there are even some surgeons who advocate resection of the gluteus medius, gluteus minimus muscles, which often tend to be badly traumatized when you're doing posterior approaches, and you know they're right up against the fracture site and often take the brunt of the damage. So I think those are some of the key points. I don't want to go too over time here. Clearly, it's a huge topic, and I think reviewing the videos, looking at the anatomy, reviewing some of the book chapters, I think helps give you more details. But this is just some of the key points in this podcast. Thank you.